We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Hello, my name is Pat. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Pat.
And I'm grateful to be sober, and I'm grateful to be in this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to thank Tatiana for asking me to participate in my recovery and to come down here. And I want to let you know that your energy and spirit inspires me to continue to do Alcoholics Anonymous one day at a time. And I want to thank the committee for allowing me to come down here. The committee has treated me and my guests very nice, and I want to thank you. And I'm actually on the International Conference of Young People in Alcoholics Anonymous Committee, and I get to see how much work it takes to put on one of these things. And you know, and I want to thank you guys. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to welcome you. I want to let you know that Alcoholics Anonymous is the single most important thing in my life today. And it wasn't always like that. My first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I was 11 months old. And didn't have a drinking problem then, but my mom was getting sentenced to 10 years in prison. And the judge, you know, in the middle of sentencing, offered her an opportunity to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so she went to AA, and so did I. And I guess I really had no choice. And I grew up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, the love that I feel in Alcoholics Anonymous today was the love that I was raised with. And, you know, I'd go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd, you know, run up to you, and I'd, you know, pull on your pant leg, and you'd take care of me. And I'd run on, you know, I'd get bored with you and then come over here and play with you. And you'd be like, here's a dollar, go buy something at the coffee bar or something and send me on my way. And, you know, the women that my mom sponsored would be like, hey, can I take him for the weekend? She'd be like, sure. And I'd be like off, you know, off with these women. And you know, I'd go to conventions. I remember the convention, the Southern California Convention of the Town and Country. And that's a big place. And when you're a kid, it's really big. And it was like Disneyland. And, you know, I grew up here. And I would sit in the back of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they would read Chapter 5, and I'd recite Chapter 5. And, you know, they'd read the 12 traditions, and I'd recite that. And, you know, at the end of the meeting, everyone would hold hands and do the Lord's Prayer, and I'd do that with you guys. And, you know, a friend of my mom, she used to always tell me, we're saving this seat right here for you. And I didn't know what that meant at the time. I thought it was like when I was done playing, like I'd come in, had a place to sit. you know, I'd go to AA, and I had a lot of love in my life. I was 9 years old. I was at an AA meeting. And I used to run around with these kids. Their parents brought them to AA too. So we'd run around meetings together. And we were in the parking structure of this hospital on a Saturday night meeting. And these kids pulled out a bottle of Jose Cuervo. And I didn't know what alcohol was going to do to me or for me. But I remember that bottle going around. And I remember telling myself, you know, you better hold it down. Because if you don't, you're not going to be liked. And I went around and I took a pull off that bottle. I didn't like the taste. And I spit it out. And I was overcome with fear. And what that fear was that I wasn't going to be liked for the rest of my life. It didn't have an effect on those three or four kids I was with. It was going to be for the rest of my life. And it went back around, and I was talking to myself. I've been talking to myself since I was a little kid, but I was talking to myself, telling myself, you better hold it down, because if you don't, you're not going to be liked. And it went back around, and I took a pull off that bottle, and I held it down. And for the first time, I didn't get drunk, but for the first time in my life, I felt okay with you. I felt equal to you. I felt that I could communicate with you. I felt like I was one of you. And, you know, and I went home that night, I didn't get drunk, and I slowly stopped coming to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with my mom. And the reason why I share that story is because, you know, as I'm sober today, I know that if meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous were the only thing to keep you sober, I'd have never taken my first drink. And, you know, I slowly stopped coming to AA with my mom, and, you know, my mom's a single parent. She didn't even know she was pregnant till she went into labor. She's a blackout drinker, and, you know, so I was raised without a father, and, you know, and I remember those feelings as a kid, being raised without a father and not having that connection with a dad, and we'd be at school, and it'd be like Father's Day time, and, you know, the teacher's like, okay, we're going to make ties for the dads, and I would just, like, clown the kids, and I'd be like, that tie's dumb, you know, this is stupid, why do we have to do this? Because I didn't want you to know how I felt on the inside, and that's how I acted out without letting you know. And you know, I didn't come to AA with my mom, and I was a latchkey kid. I never wore a key around my neck. It was under the mat, so maybe I was a mat key kid. I don't know. But, you know, they call me a latchkey kid. I grew up on box cereal and macaroni and cheese. And, you know, my mom would work all day, and then she would go to her AA meeting. And I knew that my mom's AA meeting ended at 10, and I had to be home by 10:30. So I can do whatever I wanted until my mom got home. And as long as I was in bed, my mom would flip the light on, look at me, and... you know, and I was in bed, I was okay. And back then, I liked the feeling. I grew up at Dana Point, and I liked that feeling. We'd go to the harbor, and we'd break into cars, and go to the hotel and take off all the light things and, like, stack them all in front of someone's door so when they came out. But what I really liked was, like, when the security guard chased you and you would run, and then you'd, like, run him in circles, and he'd get frustrated, so he'd call the police. You know, then the police would come down and they would chase you, and you had to get home. Then you weren't running them in circles. And I remember running in my front door, jumping in my bed, and my heart just going go 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 go. And I love that feeling. I love that excitement. And I was sitting here right now, and my heart was doing that, and I wasn't liking it now. But you know, and I was thinking about it, I was like, wow, I used to like that feeling, and I wasn't liking it. And, you know, and I started just hang out with kids that do what I like to do. And you know, I was drinking on a daily basis at 11 years old. And, you know, my freshman year in high school, I got kicked out at 2 months with enough Saturday schools and detentions to last the whole year. And so I went to live with a family in Grass Valley, and they were real strict, so I ended up getting straight A's. And for the first time in my life, I had somewhat of accomplishment that I could do something good for myself. And I came back down to live down here in Southern California, and my mom had moved to Mission Viejo, and I went to a new school. So I found people that I'd gravitate towards, people that do the things that I like to do. And before I knew it, you know, I was drinking, and I was getting straight Fs. I mean, I made it to my senior year with, like, freshman credits. The only reason I went to school was to find out where the party was. I learned how to panhandle at school. We would wait at the end of the lunch line, and people would buy their lunch, and I'd say, hey, spare change. And then we'd get the money. We'd get the money, and we'd go to the liquor store, and we'd get alcohol, and we'd drink, and, you know, after school and every day and, you know, through the night. And, you know, I was 16 years old. I got caught with a bag of weed. My mom's 16 years sober at this time. She's speaking all over the United States. She sponsors a lot of women. And, you know, she pulled me aside. She's like, you know what, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can't have this stuff in my house. And if I find this stuff in my house again, I'm going to have to kick you out. And I was like, well, all right, easy enough. I'll just hide it better. And so I started hiding it better. You know, I started hiding it good, and I got away with it for about a month. And, you know, I was already blacking out. I remember coming out of a blackout with my pants at my ankles, and I was peeing on the fish tank, and I would come home, and I would, like, hold on to things and make sure that, you know, really quiet, like I'm stealth and really quiet, and get in my bed like no one can hear. And I came to the door one night, and it was locked, and you know, it was always unlocked. And I went to the door, and I had to ring the doorbell, and I remember my mom coming to the door, and she was full of tears, and she was crying, and you know, what I heard that night was that, you know, when I found this stuff again, you're going to have to leave. But what my mom told me again was that, you know, I told you can't have this stuff, and if you want to have this stuff here, you have to leave. And so I went into my room, I packed a little backpack, and I left. And, you know, since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was the second resentment that I had. I had a resentment against my father, who was never there in my life, but this was the one that drove me. Because I remember leaving there talking to myself, saying, I'm going to show you. I'm going to do whatever it takes to ruin your life. I'm going to go out from here, and I'm going to do whatever it takes to ruin your life. I'm your only child, you know, and I know that you love me, and I'm going to do whatever it takes to hurt you. And I went out from there, and you know, my mom let me sleep on the driveway in my van for a while, but I couldn't go inside, and I just left, and I became homeless, and I was living in my van, and then the police impounded that thing. Because they would come find me, and I'd be sleeping in there. And this is in Mission Viejo. I mean, it's not like the city, you know. So it's like they knew this van. Plus, it had like graffiti pieces on the side of it, and it was a sore thumb, that's for sure. And I came back to my house, and it was gone. So I reported stolen, and they said, "Oh no, we impounded that thing for 30 days for investigation purposes." Okay. So I'm like, "Well, how much is that going to cost me?" They're going to be about $1,100 to get it out at the end of the month, and I didn't have $1,100. I let that thing go, and I had an opportunity. I was wasted. My problem was that I didn't go to school. Maybe if I went to school, everything would be all right. And my mom and another member of Alcoholics Anonymous pulled me aside, and they said, "Anywhere you want to go to school, you can go to school." I was like, "Okay, San Francisco sounds like a good place to go to school." And I'm already drinking. I'm full-blown drinking on a daily basis. I'm already, like, heart having problems, thinking, should I take this stuff? Of course. And I'm already, like, questioning if I should be continuing on. And I go to San Francisco, and my mom goes there with me, and we go to Goodwill, and we get all this furniture, and my mom's upstairs in the 16th floor of this building cleaning it, and I'm going downstairs to get my furniture, and I go to go in the building, and there's a guy, he's shooting heroin, and his wife's smoking crack, and I go upstairs, I'm like, "Hey, Mom, I think this is a bad place to be," and she's like, "We already signed the lease, this is where you're going to have to live," and I went up there, and my mom left that night, and I remember sitting on the balcony, and I just began to cry, and the only one in my life that I loved or that was it had any connection to it just left, and now I'm 450 miles from home, and I'm sitting up there crying, and there was a liquor store downstairs, and I knew exactly what would take those feelings away. And I went down there, and I wasn't 21 yet, but I manipulated the guy to serve me alcohol, and he gave me alcohol, and I went upstairs, and I drank. And what happened for me was all those feelings went away, and finally I became one with the universe, and I became one with my environment, and I became an equal. And before I knew it, I started doing the things that they were doing there. And if anyone's familiar with San Francisco, that apartment was on Turk and Hyde in the middle of Tenderloin. And I start doing the things they do because I gotta fit in, whatever that takes. What time am I done here? Five? Okay. So I'm living on the streets there. I took a hostage. She was my girlfriend. She paid for the rent, paid for the food, all that. And what happened was that she got sick of me, and now I'm living on the streets. And I went to YMCA camp. I was a camp counselor. Drinking on a daily basis at camp. I would show up at Saturday morning to meet the parents. Up all night, eating LSD. And I'd show up with my orange juice and a big smile and be like, "Hi, I'm your camp counselor." And I would meet the parents, and they would send their kids away with me. And I would drink there every day, and I got voted best camp counselor of the year. And I'd be singing campfire songs. And they asked me next year, "Hey, would you like to come back to be a boys unit director?" I was like, "Sure." So I came back to be boys unit director, and I got asked to become a boys unit director. And at this time, I'm strung out on heroin. I'm doing heroin on a daily basis. I went to camp one year, and they looked at me, and they said, "We don't want you here anymore." Well, they didn't even invite me back. I just showed up with my bag. "Hey, I'm here." The director's like, "We don't want you here anymore. You're going to have to leave," and put me on a boat. It was in Catalina, and sent me back. And that was another good thing in my life that gave me that taught me about any kind of spirituality, taught me about God, taught me about love. And so I get back to the island, and I call my mom, like, "Mom, I need to go to rehab." This time my mom's running an adolescent rehab in Orange. And she sent me to Betty Ford because she wants the best treatment for her son. And I go to Betty Ford, I do 28 days there, and I have this counselor who cares about me. And he's like, "Okay, we got to do the first step." I'm like, "Oh, yeah. I admit that I'm powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanageable." He's like, "Okay, step two." And I'm like, "Oh, yeah, I believe in a God that's going to restore me to sanity." And yeah, because I know the steps by heart. And I do step three. And I'm not honest with this guy who genuinely cares about me. He wants the best for me. And I'm just BSing my way. And I went to Betty Ford because I was a heroin addict. I wasn't an alcoholic. And I went there, and they had to teach me what no fraternizing was. I didn't know what that meant. I wasn't allowed to talk to the girls, they taught me. Well, I'm a good alcoholic. I wrote a note that morning. the boys walk this way around the lake, and the girls walk this way around the lake, and I pass this note off. And 28 days later, we fell in love. And part of the after program was to go to sober living, so I wrote her a note. Where do you want to go to sober living? She said, Hawaii. I said, sounds like a good idea. I've never surfed. I grew up on the beach, but I never surfed. And I figured that I, you know, go there and find, become one with the ocean and find God. And so I get on the plane to go to Hawaii, and you know, my mom's giving me the money for sober living, and I get on the plane, and the stewardess asked me what I wanted to drink, and hadn't admitted I was an alcoholic, wasn't honest with another human being, and a Heineken sounded just about right. So the stewardess brought me a Heineken, and 12 or 13 Heinekens later, I landed in Hawaii, and it was sober living on the left, and there was this bar on the right, and there was like 350 people in that bar. It was live music. It was like 2 in the afternoon, and sober living wasn't sounding like a good idea. And I walked in that bar, and I ordered another drink, and I remember drinking that drink down and looking around. There wasn't anyone else in that bar. It was me and one other guy at the end of the bar. He had no teeth, and at that moment, I knew that I was going to be living this way for the rest of my life. And, you know, I'm on the streets in Hawaii, and I come, you know, I manipulate my way to come back, and I go to San Francisco, I'm in and out of jail, I got a DUI, I got a possession charge, I'm looking at 3.5 years in prison, I'm in and out of jail, in and out of jail, in and out of jail, and it's going to be different next time. You know, I'm not going to drink, and I'd get out of jail, and I'd be at that 7-Eleven just to buy a pack of cigarettes, and I'd be walking out with, a 12-pack of beer, and I'd be like, how did that happen? I wasn't going to drink, I have all these consequences, what are you doing? And it's too late, the phenomenon of craving's developed, I'm gone, and then I'm back to San Francisco. And I'm calling my mom, and I'm manipulating my mom, you know, and I'd be like, oh, mom, I fell, bumped my head, I need to get stitches. And she's like, well, you know, I'll send you a check. Well, yeah, I don't have an address, you know, I'm homeless. But she doesn't know that. And I'm like, well, they need the money now. She's like, well, how am I going to do this? I'm like, well, you just go down to the liquor store. It's called MoneyGram. She's like, well, I don't know how to do that. So I taught my mom how to wire money. She went down to the liquor store, wired me $150, and this went on for 2 years. 3 times a week, $150 every time. And, you know, my mom's active in Alcoholics Anonymous, and here's her son just killing himself. And I remember my mom on the other telling me, you know what, Patrick, you know, I'm just waiting for the call from the morgue telling me that come identify the body. And she would tell me, why don't you go to AA, go to an AA meeting? And I would tell her, I don't want to be your son. I said, you know, they're going to know me in San Francisco. They're going to know who you are, and they're going to know me. And I don't want the old timers to tell me, I remember you when you were this big. And I didn't want to be, and I would tell her that. I go, I don't want to be your son. Just, leave, you know, I don't want to go to AA. And I'd go to AA, and I'd not come. And it was 2 years went on like that. And, you know, it's funny. I saw Corey here. As far as I know, she's the only person that's seen me loaded. And, you know, I was manipulating my mom, and she was with my mom, and they picked me up at the train station, and I had this great idea, and you owe me $5. And and she's one of those people that have seen me in that. And so basically it took me another 2 years, so I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I got here, I hadn't taken a shower in 6 months. I was up for 21 days. I hadn't eaten for 14. I had two shoes. Only one had a sole, a bottom. And I had a stolen bike and a stolen beach cruiser, and I was seeing the devil and his troops. They followed me wherever I went, and heard voices in my head, and they told me where to go and who to do things to. And so the solution to that idea was that I found these two sticks about this long. I found a newspaper, had some twine, so I untwined it, and I tied these two sticks like a cross. And I stuck them in the handlebars of my bike, and I rolled around Hollywood like that. It worked. And then I would come down, and it would all come back. I was looking at 3.5 years in prison. The last plan idea that I had was try to take my life. And my mom had found Al-Anon, and the money stopped coming, and it was a little harder to manipulate. I was sentenced to do the Salvation Army, a little program there, rather than the 9 months. And I'd been in and out of jail telling them to, screw yourself. And the judge, last time I saw him, the judge told me he was going to sentence me to 3.5 years in prison if I didn't do the program. So last plan idea I had, I called some friends, got some things that I needed. manipulated my mom to get me a motel room. It was like the wagon wheel, you know. It wasn't like the Hyatt. And I stole a 30-pack of beer, and I went up in that motel room, and I closed the blinds, and I proceeded to kill myself. I went for the first attempt. My heart went out, and I remember coming to in this motel room, and I was full of anger. And the anger was that I hadn't graduated high school. I ruined every relationship in my life, and I couldn't even kill myself, right? And I went for the second attempt. My heart went out again. I was laying in this motel room floor. I was in the fetal position. I had liquid coming out of every hole in my body, and I had a moment of clarity. And the moment of clarity for me was that something other than me had a reason for me to be here. And I didn't know what it was, and I said, whoever you are and whatever you are, I can't live with this insanity in my head, and obviously you have another purpose for me here. And I did what every tough street kid does. I picked up the phone and called my mommy and asked for help again. And I remember my mom on the other end of the line saying, you know what, Patrick? She said, I can't help you anymore. She said, just stay right where you are, and someone from Alcoholics Anonymous will come get you. She said, because if I come get you, I'm going to end up killing you. You know, my mom wasn't going to come with a gun and blow my head off, but if she would have came one more time, I'd have manipulated her one more time, and I know I wouldn't be standing here tonight.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
And she hung up the phone on me, and these two guys came, and I tried to clean up the motel room as good as I could through some, you know, clothes that didn't have liquid on them, and they were real greased up, but they didn't have liquid on them, and I had a hood over my head, and I was just shaking, and these two guys came in this motel and got me, and I didn't know where I was going, and I didn't really care, and they put me in this van, and they told me if I needed to throw up, just to throw up on the floor. They called it a 12-step van. I didn't know what that meant at the time. This guy had really big hair, really push hair. He was loud. He was obnoxious. He's like, come with me, kid. Let's go. And there was an older gentleman with him, and they put me in this van. This guy wouldn't shut up. And I'm like, dude, just shut up. Like, I can't take this, you know. And he starts telling me his story. And he starts talking, he's driving, telling me a story, and he's talking about losing the kids and losing the wife and losing the business. And I start talking to myself, and I start saying, you haven't been the places that I've been or done the things that I've done. And right when I started saying that to myself, he started talking about the way he felt when he got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he talked about that shame, he talked about that guilt, he talked about that loneliness, and he talked about that fear. And for the first time in my life, I related to another human being, And before I knew it, I was at this detox at Charlie Street in Costa Mesa. And just to give you an idea of how I was, they put me on the couch and they told me, this is your seat. They said, you don't have to give it up to anyone if you don't want to. So I went to bed that night and I came out and there was a guy in my seat. And I'm like, dude, you're in my seat. Get up. I thought that was my chair, right? Like, that's, I own that, you know, that's mine. Guy's like, dude, I was here first. I'm like, no, that's my seat. It was a couple days into it. I kind of came clear a little bit. And the guy said, hey, do you have a sponsor? And I was like, I don't know how to ask for one. He said, it's easy. Just say, hey, will you be my sponsor? And I was like, okay, easy enough. Because I didn't want to stay sober. I just didn't want to feel the way I was feeling anymore. And he said, well, what do you say? And I said, will you be my sponsor? And he said, sure. He put out his hand. He said, sure, I'll be your sponsor. He gave me a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He told me to read the first 164 pages. And he said, as sick as you are, I want you to read the preface and the forewords too. And I went up in that little room and I started reading the big book, and it was like Japanese to me. I didn't know what it, Bill, yeah, all that stuff. I couldn't retain anything. I don't know if anyone can relate to that. I couldn't. I would read and be like, wait, what did I just read? And then I would read back And he came back to see me, and he would come back every day, and he'd bring me cigarettes, and he'd bring me a Coke, and he would come every day of that detox to see me, finally he was like, so how's that reading going? I was like, oh, it went good, you know, but I don't remember anything that I read. I'm having a hard time retaining. He said, he related his story, and he was like, you know, I can relate. He's like, what we're going to do is we're going to sit down, and we're going to read word for word and line for line out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he began to do that with me. And what happened as he was doing reading word for word, line for line, he started relating his story to the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what happened for me was I was able to relate my story with the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that Big Book started to become life to me. And it started to become reality, and it started to become real. And I went to go see the judge, not by choice. He asked me, sober living. I was like, okay. I was like, yeah, but I have to do the Salvation Army program. And then I kind of went on. He's like, wait, back up. What's up with that Salvation Army program? I was like, well, and I told him, I got a little trouble, and I got to do the Salvation Army program and be sentenced at 3.5 years. And he's like, oh, so you have a warrant? I was like, yeah. He said, well, we're going to go see that judge at South Court. I had like 6 days of sobriety. I'm like, oh, no, we're not, I was like, can't we wait to have like 90 days or something, maybe get a couple letters, and then we'll go see the judge and tell him how good of a job I'm doing and what good AA member I am. He's like, no, we're going to go down there today, tomorrow and see him. And he threw me up in this nice sweater, and I was like uncomfortable. And he took me to see this judge, and it was 11:30 in the morning. They're getting called for break, and the judge goes, wait, who's he? And then the little lady tells him, and he's like, oh, we'll pull his file now. And he calls me up, and the judge looks down, and he said, you know what, Patrick? He said, last time you were in my courtroom, I told you I was going to sentence you to 3.5 years in prison, and I wasn't lying. And he closed the file, put it off. The guard came, cuffed me up, and I'm walking downstairs, and when my sponsor told me that he was going to take me to see the judge, he had told me, it's going to be okay, everything's going to be all right. And so now I'm walking, getting cuffed, going down the holding tank to go to prison for 3.5 years, and I'm thinking, this isn't all right. And I instantly went back to that little kid that was raised without a father, that didn't trust men, that didn't like men, that didn't, all that stuff. And I instantly went back there, and I started shutting off. And I went down that holding tank, I got on my knees, and I started praying to that same God that I prayed to on day one. And I didn't care who was looking at me. Hey, what are you doing, dude? I'm trying to get out of here, bro. It was 4:30 in the afternoon, we were getting shackled up to get put on the bus, and I was third in line, I heard my last name called. And the guard looked at me and she said, I don't know what's going on, but the judge wants to see you. And I went up in that courtroom and the judge looked at me and he said, I don't know why I'm doing this, but I'm going to give you another chance. He said, there's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who's been sitting at this courtroom all day fighting for you to get out, and they have a bed available for you at the Salvation Army. He said, but you are not to stop anywhere from this courtroom to the Salvation Army. And I got to the Salvation Army and I walked in, and the counselor looked at me and said, Pat? I looked at him. I said, Tim? He said, how you doing? And it was a guy I used to get loaded with, who was sober, who was a counselor, and God was working in my life long before I even knew what was going on. And he said, I got a call that you were, you need to be here. So I got you a bed. And I was at the Salvation Army, and that sponsor would come get me every day to do step work every Sunday. And we got in a four-step, and he write, column by column. He's like, we'll make this real easy for you. Who are you resentful at? And then he'd come back next week. Let's see your homework. And then he'd make me do the next column. And we got to my part. And if anyone's familiar with the Salvation Army, I had to wake up at 4:30 in the morning, work, all 40 hours a week. They give you a little $10 gratuity. And so he came to see my homework on my part. And I was like, oh, man, too busy. Salvation Army, slave labor, They're like, And he looked at me square in the eyes and he said, son, when you want to stop dying, he said, give me a call. And he turned around and walked out of that Salvation Army and left. And I was like, oh, my feelings come back, And I got it. And for me, what happened was I got it at that moment that this disease was going to kill me. And if I wasn't willing to do the work, I was going to drink. And I knew at that moment if I drank, to drink was to die. And I went up in my little room and I wrote out the rest of that inventory. And he came back and I did the fear inventory. He'd come pick me up in his convertible Porsche, and before I'd get in it, he'd throw me a rag, a dry rag, and I'd go, what's this for? He's like, wipe it down. I'd go, okay, and I'd wipe his Porsche down, and then I can get in. And then we'd get to his house in Newport Beach, and he'd throw me a roll of wallpaper, and I'd be like, what's this for? He's like, start hanging wallpaper. So I'd hang wallpaper at his house, and I'd get to the meeting, and he'd say, see that greeting line? At the main speaker meeting in Laguna Beach? I'm like, yeah. He's like, go greet. And I was like, I don't know what to do. And he goes, well, I'll do it with you. He's like, all you have to say is your name is Pat, you're an alcoholic, and you don't know shit. So 150 to 200 people come in every Saturday night, and I'd be saying that. And after the meeting, I'd go, okay, and I'd go smoke a cigarette or, you know, try to, like, rub up on some girl or, I don't know. He would grab me by the shirt tail, and he'd be like, nope. I'm like, well, what do I have to do now? He's like, you see all those chairs? I'm like, yeah. He's like, start stacking them. And I'd start stacking chairs, and I'd get done with the chairs, and he'd give me a mop, and I'd start mopping the floors. And I got busy in Alcoholics Anonymous against what I wanted to do, and I didn't know what was happening. And he came to pick me up, do my fifth step, and I started reading it to him, and we got to the laundromat, and he's like, okay. He's like doing his dirty white laundry, and I'm just kind of hanging out. Maybe we're going to go to the beach or something. He looked at me, he's like, start reading. And I was like, dude, there's people around, you know? Like, I don't want people hearing this stuff. He's like, they don't speak English anyways, it's okay. And so I started reading that fifth step, and what that experience taught me was all that stuff that I'd been holding on to for all those years wasn't really that big of a deal. It was only a big deal, was in my own mind. And I got done with my fifth step, got down to this house on the beach in Newport, and he opened the book and he says, returning home. He's like, you're homeless. He's like, we'll use my home as your home. He's like, what I want you to do is I want you to go down and look over the first five proposals, and we went over that. And so I went down, I had my little four step, and I went down there and I went over the first five proposals, and have I omitted anything? And I was like, got that secret I'm going to the grave with. And I began to pray, and I began to ask God to remove those character defects. It wasn't a voice, I'm not schizophrenic, but it was a deep down inner feeling that told me, if you don't tell your sponsor that secret, you're going to end up drinking. And I knew from the four step thing that if I drank, I was going to die. And I didn't want to die at that point. And so I went back to the response. I'm like, hey, sponsor, I left this thing out. And I told him, and I became free of all that stuff. I got done and went right back. It was an hour. It was a little about an hour and a half. Got back. He's like, all right, start writing an eight-step list. And I wrote an eight-step list, and I went through my inventory, pulled all that stuff off, and then I had a lot of things that I like to steal. So I put all that stuff on there, and I made amends to my mom, and I manipulated my mom for a lot of money, what my sponsor, I had to pay my mom back, and she's like, you know what, Patrick, all I want you to do is stay sober. And I was like, yes, get out of this one. And I went back to my sponsor, and I told him, he's like, no, you need to give your mom $25 a week. So I was living with my mom, and I was put $25 a week, on the coffee pot on Friday. And then he told me, he's like, what I want you to do is I want you to write her a note with that $25. I want you to tell her that you love her and you appreciate her in your life. And I started doing that. And the relationship I have with my mom today is the best thing I could have ever had. I shared a podium with my mom on Thursday, and she wrote me an email after saying, I'm proud of you and I love you. And even greater than the relationship I have with my mom today from that note, what that note has allowed me to do is to look at you in the eye and tell you that I love you and I appreciate you in my life today. It's allowed me to take the newcomer's hand and tell him I love you and I appreciate you and come with me and enjoy the road of recovery and show him what we do. And I didn't come here to love anybody. I came here because I didn't want to feel the way I was feeling anymore, and I started to get benefits, and I started to get rewards, and I got a year of sobriety, and my sponsor told me that what we're going to do is we're going to get your file, we're going to write a letter, and we're going to go to that judge, and you're going to thank him for your sobriety. So I go see this judge. He wasn't at the court anymore. We had to track him down. We went to another court, and I give him this file, this letter, thanking him for my life and for my sobriety, and with my little chip, and he goes, no, you can keep the chip. I was like, no, they give me a lot of them. You can have this. You can have this one. He read the letter and he looked at me and he said, son, he said, with this job, sometimes you have to go with your gut feeling. He said, by you coming in here today has proven my gut feeling right. He said, by you coming in here today allows me to give another alcoholic another chance. What happened for me was the hair on the back of my neck stood up. I got the goosebumps and I knew I was free. I was 90 days of sobriety. I left the Salvation Army. I had a better idea. There's a homeless shelter in Laguna Beach. It's about a half a block from the ocean because I could work there and save money. It seemed like it was a good idea. Even though the judge was going to sentence me to 3.5 years and gave me a break. And I left anyways, and I went down there, and I got a job, and I got letters from people in AA, and I'm doing a good job, and I go to turn myself in and tell him, doing this a lot better than you had suggested. And he looked at me, and he violated me. He gave me a 90-day violation on probation, and I remember getting cuffed up. I remember going down in the holding tank, and at that time when I got sent down, I knew that I was clearing up the wreckage of my past. I knew at that moment I wasn't angry at the judge. I had known my part. I knew I was good. And I went down there, and I went to jail, and I couldn't get a big book for the first 2 weeks. And my mom would pass out business cards around AA with my booking number and the address. And I would start getting letters from people in AA that I didn't know. And I'd get 4 to 5 letters a day, and I had visiting Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And my mom would come one day, my sponsor would come the next, and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous would come on the third one. And then I got a big book, and I started studying that big book like my life depended upon it in jail. And I'm in these 8-man tanks. They're shooting speed on Tuesday. They're shooting heroin on Thursdays. They're drinking on a daily basis. They're smoking weed, and they're doing all the things that I like to do. And I remember the guys would be like, "Hey, you want some?" And I'd be like, "Oh, no, I'm cool." And they let it go, and they're like, "Hey, you want some?" I'm like, "Oh, no, I'm cool." And you know, the shock caller in the tank said, "Hey," he's like, "You know, what are you, a narc or something?" And I was like, "No, you know," I go, "actually, you know what?" I sat these 8 guys down. It was like, you know, 12 o'clock midnight, and I started telling them my story. And I started telling them what happens if I do that stuff, where I go and what I do. And I got done, and they looked at me, and they're like, "You're right. We don't want to give you any." And and so I got done telling my story, and this guy came to me the next day. He's like, "I'm looking at 10 years in prison." He said, "I need help." And so I was like, "Hey, dude, go to the judge. Hey, just ask me you want the Salvation Army. They released me. Maybe they'll release you." And he went to court a couple days later, and he came back. He's like, "Hey, they released me to the Salvation Army." I was like, "Hey, I told you." And so he's going to the Salvation Army, and he looked at me, and he's like, "How you know?" He asked me for help, and he's like, "You know what? I don't know how to stay sober, and I need help." And I did what my first sponsor did for me, was I got the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we sat in my bunk and we read word for word, line for line, out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started relating my story to the big book. And he began to relate his story to the big book, and he started identifying, and we started talking about a God of my own understanding and spiritual values and spiritual principles and spiritual beliefs. And he started lighting up, and I started to see hope in his eyes. And we got to the 4-step in the big book, and he started writing an inventory. And my little 90-day little sentence was up, and I was like, you know, and I went about my way, and he was getting out shortly after, and I went to visit him at the Salvation Army, and he was doing good, and I was going to visit him like my sponsor did for me, and, you know, and he ended up leaving. He ended up getting loaded, and he ended up going to jail for 10 years. And, you know, it was a couple months later, and I was talking to myself once again, and I was like, "You know what, Pat, how'd you stay sober through that, you know, that jail experience?" And what I came to understand is that by one alcoholic working with another was the only thing that allowed me to stay sober in that jail. And I've been able to apply that to my life today. And I know that by working with another alcoholic allows me another chance to stay sober one day at a time. And I apply that to my life today. And you know, I my life today is full. It's busy. You know, I'm on an all Orange County Young People and Alcoholics Anonymous committee. I'm on ICKYPA now, and 4 months ago I had a little baby boy, and I go to school full time, and I was like, "How's this gonna work?" You know, I go to school, you know, I get like financial aid, I DJ here and there to like get a couple extra $100 so that I can focus on school, and I was like, "How's this gonna work?" And she's like, "You know what, I want to work, and I want you to go to school, and I want you to raise our son." And, you know, and I'm a camp counselor. I've loved kids. I'm going to school to be an adolescent probation officer, and it's the biggest joy in my life today, other than sobriety and working with the new guys. It's unexplainable for me. And so I'm only taking one class, and I watch this little boy, and I look in that little boy. Well, I'll go back to his birth. So he was born. He was, you know, I'm in the waiting room. My mom's taking pictures, and his head starts coming out, and the doctor says, "Oh, this is a beautiful picture." And we're looking at this thing, going, "No way." I'm like, no way, that's not a beautiful picture at all. And all of a sudden, the doctor did something, and his head turned right at me, and it was just this perfect little face, and his eyes were closed. And at that moment, I saw God. It was that pure, innocent love that God has given me from when I was born. But when I was able to start seeing God, it was that pure, innocent love. And I saw that right there at that moment. And that kid came out, and it's new territory for me. I'm like walking to Target in the day, There's like all these moms. I'm walking through Target, the parking lot, and this cop comes circling through, and I'm pushing my stroller, going to get some food. The cop comes around. He's like, hey, is there a kid in there? I'm like, yeah, come check him out, I thought he wanted to see my son, So he's like, okay, thanks. He gets back in his car and leaves. So he's a joy in my life. It was about a month, 2 months ago, there was a men's international conference, this little, the pamphlet pre-registration. And I saw it at one of my meetings, and I was like, oh, I picked it up. I was like, rallied up some of my friends. And I was like, oh, you guys, let's go to this thing, And we register. And then I'm like, wait a second, where'd that come from? Here's a kid that never trusted men. I have a sponsor that knows everything about me, and I tell him everything about me out of just, because I don't want to drink anymore. That connection with a man is hard for me to get. I have so many walls built. And I'm thinking, whoa, where did that come from? And I go to this conference, and I participate in my recovery, it was closing day. It was Sunday. That I was thank Tom I for speaking, and I was like fourth in line. I looked up on stage, and the chairman of the conference was standing there. He was about 65 years old, and these men were coming up walking, and they were giving him a hug, and it was like long hugs, And they were thanking the chairman for the opportunity to be a part of this conference. And I looked in this man's eyes, and there was just tears just all coming up right here. And I looked at him in the eyes, and I began to cry. And what has happened for me is that my son has allowed me to start healing from that process of my father. And I didn't know that was going to happen. I didn't know that this little kid was going to give me all this healing. I didn't know that this kid was going to give me joy. It was like, oh my God, what am I going to do? But what I do today is I turn my will and life over to a God that I don't understand. I turn my will and life over to a God that's had my back all along. And good things have come about. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I sponsor guys. I have a guy that comes in and out. And I just ask you to stay. Alcoholics Anonymous seems to be a lot easier if you stay than it is to come back. And that's all I have. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.